Today's sponsor is Care Of, which is a wellness brand that makes it simple to maintain health goals with a customized vitamin plan. All of their products are formulated with clean ingredients backed by science. They're super transparent about the research and sourcing behind each product. You do an online quiz at careof.com about your diet, lifestyle, and health concerns to help address your specific wellness goals. I took the quiz because I needed some vitamins that could help my skin, hair, and brain. They recommended a number of vitamins, including vegetarian collagen to help improve my skin, vegetarian omega to help improve my hair, and American ginseng to help with my short-term memory, as well as a couple of others. Once you get your recommendations, they come in daily individual wrap packets that takes the hassle out of purchasing numerous bottles of vitamins. Also, if you prefer taking powders, you can also select those instead. It couldn't be any simpler to take control of your health with Care Of. And Morbidology listeners get a special promo code. For 50% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter code Morbidology50. That is promo code Morbidology50 at takecareof.com. Before we get started with today's episode, I'd like to take a second to talk about the podcast Follow Friday. It's a weekly podcast hosted by Eric Johnson, where he speaks with internet creators that he admires. As podcast fans, I'm sure you all have your own favorite internet creators, whether it be a podcast host or even a writer or YouTuber. The internet is made up of millions of people, but each person's internet is completely different, because we all like different things and we all follow different people. That's where Follow Friday comes in. Each week, Eric chats with an internet creator about who they like to follow online. It's the perfect podcast for finding out what other people in the world are up to and to find new people to follow. Eric gives his guests a list of categories, such as someone who makes you laugh or someone who inspires you. And then his guest picks four people who fit into the categories. It's a real feel-good podcast and helped me find Ska Tune Network, which is an amazing YouTube that makes ska covers. So if you want to listen, head on over to followfridaypodcast.com or just search for Follow Friday in your favourite podcast app. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Blackstone is a town of less than 10,000 near the Rhode Island border in Massachusetts. It's a quaint suburban area away from the hustle and bustle of city life in Boston, which is just 50 miles away. On a quaint street just four blocks away from the local police station sat an unassuming Cape Cod-style home. However, what went on behind those closed doors would traumatize even the most seasoned detectives. It was the 28th of August, 2014, when authorities were alerted to a home in St. Paul Street, Blackstone, Massachusetts. The neighbor of the family who lived in said home contacted authorities to report that the 10-year-old boy living there had come to her and asked her how to get a baby to stop crying. The neighbor followed the boy over to the house and when she went in, she first of all noticed the putrid smell and the squalid conditions. She found a six-month-old baby lying on a bed covered in feces and maggots. In another room, she found a three-year-old boy in the same condition. Small handprints and feces were dotted across the walls. There were no adults around. The neighbor had moved into the neighborhood around a year earlier, and her son had played with the 10-year-old boy on occasion, although her son had never been inside the house. The neighbor had no idea that there were other children inside the home, never mind children who were being so horrifically neglected. The neighbor immediately called police.
Hi, I'm just going to see if I can have somebody come over to 23 St. Paul Street.
Okay, what's going on?
I got a phone call from my son. He came over to his friend's house to do something, and he was really upset, and he kept telling me that the babies, that the babies wouldn't stop crying, and his friend's mom is out of town. She left this morning.
Yeah.
There's no one else here, and they've been at my house all day, and I just figured out that there's babies inside this house. I'm here now. They're covered in urine and feces. There's no electricity in the house. Sorry, I'm a little sick up.
What is your name, please?
And I live right around the corner. The little boy who lives here is friends with my son.
Okay, so your son is friends with one of the
little boy, his name is, comes over to the house to play. I've never been to his house before. I met his mother recently yesterday, and she had asked if he could come over this morning and hang out at our house because she was going away.
Yeah.
And I said yes.
Uh-huh.
She's been at our house all day, and I just left to go to Bellingham, and he called me and said, I can't get the baby to stop crying. Well, there's chips here. There's like little babies here.
Oh, my God.
They've been here all day. There's no one here.
Okay, and is there...
There's no electricity. There's dirty diapers. Like,
is there an apartment number?
No, it's just a house.
It's a house. Okay, 23 St. Paul Street.
It's like right here, right next door. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to send them over right now.
Do I touch these babies, or what am I doing? Can I pick these babies up, or is that... I don't know what to do.
I'm going to send the officers right over, okay?
Okay, I'll just wait. Okay,
right.
Bye.
They told her not to pick the babies up, so she stood in between the two rooms, attempting to comfort them, both from a distance. When she asked the 10-year-old boy who the babies belonged to, he said that a friend of his mother had dropped them off. When police arrived at the home, they found four children, ages 13, 10, 3, and 6 months old, living in filthy conditions. As mentioned, the two youngest were covered in feces and maggots, and the bed that the three-year-old was lying on was so soiled that it had sunk in the middle. He was soaking wet from urine. The four children were removed from the home and placed into state custody. After the children had been removed from the home, 31-year-old Erica Murray showed up. She was the mother of the children. Bill Walsh, a 20-year veteran police officer, said that he had believed that he had seen everything in his career, but this completely traumatized him. Speaking with the Boston Herald, he said, "When Erica showed up at the house that day, I told her the children had been removed and the house was sealed off." He said that Erica didn't inquire about the children, but instead asked about her cat. She was concerned that her cat, who was an indoor cat, had gotten out of the house as police searched. Erica had grown up in a rural home located along a busy road in Northbridge. It was the same home that her father, Kevin Murray, had been raised. Erica had been an average little girl. She liked to play baseball and hide and seek with her two older brothers, and she enjoyed swimming in their above-ground swimming pool. Her mother, Sharon Murray, spent much of her time crafting, while her father worked as a mechanic. Their neighbors would describe them as a regular family. As a teenager, Erica cared about her appearance. She liked to get makeovers and manicures. She attended Northbridge High School and got a job in McDonald's. The description of Erica's family when she was growing up was a lifetime away from the description of Erica as an adult. After conducting interviews with the two oldest children inside Erica's home, investigators got a search warrant to search the home even further. When they returned, what they would discover would traumatize even the most hardened officers. They found the bodies of three babies, surrounded among vermin, trash, and soiled diapers. Erica was arrested on charges relating to the living conditions in the home, but no criminal charges were filed against her. District Attorney Joseph Early Jr. said that they were not yet sure how the infants had died, nor did he know their genders or ages. He said that the home was in such squalid conditions that it would take a few days for it to be searched. They weren't yet sure if any other bodies would be found. The investigators searching the home had to wear hazardous material suits, and they said that in addition to the horrid condition the home was in, it was filled with vermin. In some areas of the home, they found used diapers piled up to 2 feet high. Investigators would find the remains of several animals, including cats and dogs, but no more human remains would be discovered. The following day, Erica was further charged with fetal death concealment out of wedlock, witness intimidation, misleading a police officer, animal cruelty, violating a restraining order, and permitting substantial injury to a child. She pleaded not guilty and was ordered to be held without bail. During the brief hearing, a court-appointed defense lawyer, Keith Halpern, suggested that Erica was mentally ill. He stated, "You want answers in circumstances like this. Mental illness doesn't always provide those kinds of answers. Investigators have to wear protective suits to go into the house, and she was living in there. Who would live in there if they weren't mentally ill?" Following the hearing, the investigation quickly focused on who the deceased children were and how they had met their demise. The two oldest living children that had been removed from the home were the children of Erica, but no birth records existed for the two youngest. Despite this, investigators believed that Erica was the mother to all of the children, both dead and alive. In regards to the three deceased children, two of them appeared to be newborns and one was an infant. A medical examiner would need to determine whether the two newborns were born alive, or whether they had been stillbirths. Investigators would soon enough announce that the three children had died at different periods of time, as opposed to all together. As news of the grim discovery swept through the area, neighbours were horrified. Marilyn Soucy, who had lived in the neighbourhood for 35 years, said that she was in complete and utter shock. She said, "I am so disgusted, it hasn't really registered in my head yet. My husband and I raised 7 children. We have 11 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. I cannot imagine ever hurting a child." She said that she and her husband, Bob, very rarely saw Erica or her long-term boyfriend, Ray Rivera, who had lived in the home for the past 3 years. She said she rarely saw the children either, but had seen the 10-year-old boy playing outside on some occasions. Neighbours were left wondering if there was something they missed or something more they could have done. Some neighbours said that they had noticed that the shades were always drawn, and some had even noticed a foul smell wafting from inside the home. One neighbour spoke with WMCT.
"I got the phone call from my children saying, 'Mom, the police and the detectives are next door, and they're taking the kids.' And I went, 'What?' In disbelief, you know what I mean? I said, 'Okay.' I said, 'Close the blinds, do what you can. Just stay in the house. Don't go in, go and disrupt anything.' And I said to me, I got home and they were like, 'Mom, the kids are gone.' And I'm like, 'What?' And I said, 'All right, I'll go over and talk to the neighbor.' And I offered the neighbor to help the neighbor. I said, 'As a community, we put pine soil and paper towels and rags and let's get in there and do what we got to do, bring these kids back home.' Well, that's when she told me, she says, 'Thanks for the offer, but I think it's a little more sick and twisted than we both want to know at this point.' And I was like, 'What?"
while Erica's boyfriend Ray lived at the home with Erica and the children, he wasn't arrested or charged with anything. Erica's lawyer would soon announce that he's optimistic that a forensic examination would show that the babies were stillborn and therefore hadn't been harmed or murdered by Erica. He also said he expected the DNA testing to show that Erica and Ray were the parents of said babies. He further revealed to the Boston Globe that Erica told him that she had secretly given birth to the two youngest children that were found in the home, because she was afraid after Ray had told her that he didn't want any more children after the first two. He said that Erica tried to conceal the fact that the two youngest children were hers, and apparently told Ray that she was simply babysitting them. Defense lawyer Keith Halpern told the Associated Press that Erica was fearful throughout all of the pregnancies, and said that he wasn't sure yet how much of the fear was attributed to Erica's mental health issues and how much was due to genuine concern. He said, "This terror just controlled her. She couldn't figure out how to get out of the prison she had created for herself. She is clearly mentally ill, because the lengths to which she went to try and hide these children, no one in their right mind would have done this." He refused to elaborate any further on why Erica was seemingly afraid of Ray, and refused to comment on what Erica had told him about the three dead babies. At the time of the discovery, the Department of Children and Families was already under intense scrutiny. They'd been lambasted because a five-year-old boy disappeared the year beforehand, and his disappearance went unnoticed for months, even though the boy's family had been monitored by the Department of Children and Families for years. An investigation into that case would reveal that social workers had missed visits and other failed opportunities to engage with the children. The discovery in the home in Blackstone had led to questions as to whether the Department of Children and Families had missed an opportunity to save the children. They acknowledged that in 2007 they had received a report of abuse or neglect in regards to the Murray family, but the report was unsupported, so no case was ever opened against the family. They said that the only issues they found in the home were dirty carpets with no evidence of abuse or neglect. A further investigation into the background of the family would show that from 2010 to 2012, there had been complaints about trash and debris piling up outside the house. Further investigation would reveal that the two oldest children had been enrolled as 3rd and 7th graders at Blackstone Millville School the year beforehand, but they never enrolled in the school system the current year. With the children not in school, many people wondered why something wasn't flagged sooner. Many people were also wondering why Ray hadn't been charged with anything. He lived in the home and was likely the father of all of the children. Erica's defense attorney Keith Halpern spoke with the Boston Herald and said that Ray was aware of the deplorable conditions, stating, "He lived in the house. They shared a bedroom." There were reports that Ray lived in the basement of the home, and Ray claimed that he had no knowledge of the deceased babies, or even of the two youngest children. But as Defence Halpern said, "He did not live exclusively in that basement. I think the notion that he barricaded himself in the basement and did not know what the rest of the house looked like is absurd." He revealed more information about the couple, who by this point were a complete and utter enigma. He said that Erica had become pregnant with Ray's child when she was a senior in high school. During the pregnancy, Ray moved in with Erica at her parents' home. Erica later became pregnant once again, and during this pregnancy, they moved into a three-bedroom home in St. Paul Street, which was owned by Ray's sister. Then Ray's sister and her family moved out, but they allowed Erica and Ray to stay in the home. A candlelight vigil was held in memory of the three babies at John F. Kennedy Elementary School soccer field on Lincoln Street. Around 200 people gathered, and three heart-shaped balloons were released in memory of the three babies. Reverend Ruth Blaze, who was pastor of the local church, asked those in attendance not to just pray for the three deceased babies, but to also pray for Erica. Meanwhile, Erica was moved to a unit in the jail for inmates who could pose a danger to themselves, while the workers in hazmat suits remained at the home attempting to clean it. A dead dog and a dead cat were found on the second floor, while drywall from one room had to be completely removed due to feces contamination. Outside of the home, a makeshift memorial was building up, as locals brought flowers, candles, teddy bears, and trinkets. The day after the funeral, Blackstone Police released police log entries for the home and stated that they had been called to the home in the past for various reasons, but never had a reason to check the conditions inside the home. In August of 2011, police and an animal control officer responded to a call from a concerned neighbour about the condition of a dog in the backyard. They said that based on the conditions found at the scene, they had no reason to enter the home. When the conditions of the house were finally uncovered, the dog was found inside. It was a small bloodhound dog and was extremely emaciated and covered in fleas. She was taken to the Medfield Animal Shelter, where she made a full recovery and was adopted out. A cat named Amy was also found inside the house, and she too made a full recovery and was adopted out. The staff at Medfield Animal Shelter said that they believed that the two pets were very likely the only comfort for the children inside the home. Shelter manager Jacqueline Walters said, "This might have been one of the only normal things in their lives, that they had a pet. All the horrors they must have seen in that house. This was normalcy, and this was a confidant." The search of the home would additionally uncover that Ray had been growing and selling marijuana out of the basement. He was arraigned on charges of possession of a Class D substance, possession with intent to distribute a Class D substance, and cultivation of marijuana. They had located magazine labels, shipping labels, and a vehicle registration, all with Ray's name on them, in the basement. Erica had told the investigators that she very rarely went into the basement, and as mentioned earlier, Ray claimed that he rarely went into the house, instead spending all of his time in the basement. The final cleanup bill of the home would be a whopping $20,000, and it would be incurred by the owner of the house. According to state law, the house was owned by Christina Rivera, the sister of Ray. Blackstone health officials wanted to tear the house down, with code enforcement officer Bill Walsh stating, "It's just a black hole in Blackstone. I don't see any other option." He said that despite the exhaustive cleanup effort, the stench from the home still remained. Members of the town's board of health said that they would be meeting with select men to discuss what to do about the house. Ultimately, it would be up to the Board of Health to decide the fate of the home, and they would decide to tear the house down, with Board Chairman William Walsh saying that the strong odour inside the home would never be suitable for habitation. Christina was served with a notice that she must demolish the home, and it was speculated that it would cost around $12,000. This meant that Christina had a hefty $32,000 fee to pay for the actions of her brother and Erica. Christina had a deadline to present the town with a plan to demolish the house, but she failed to show up. This meant that the town would be placing a lien on the property to recoup the cost, and they would be tearing the home down themselves. On the 21st of October, the home was demolished. Shortly thereafter, Erica was in court for a bail hearing. During the hearing, prosecutors revealed that they believed that at least two of the deceased babies had been alive for some period of time before they were discovered. They said that one baby had a full head of hair and had been discovered stuffed inside a backpack in a closet in an upstairs bedroom. The other two babies were discovered in another closet in the bedroom, which the two oldest children shared. Both of these babies were found wearing diapers and clothing, which led investigators to speculate that they were alive at one point and that they hadn't been stillborn. By this point, they still hadn't received the medical examiner's report, and weren't yet sure how the babies had died or what age they were. It was further revealed that the 5-month-old and the 3-year-old had been profoundly neglected and severely malnourished, adding that neither had ever been outside, and the 3-year-old could not walk or feed herself. A paediatrician said the 3-year-old had spent the majority of her life on her back and could not use her arms. He further stated that Erica had admitted to giving birth to all of her children, except the oldest two, on the floor of her bathroom. The judge ordered Erica to be held on $1 million cash bail. A number of people who knew Erica said that they only knew about the two oldest children, the 13-year-old and the 10-year-old. They said that they began to notice that Erica started to wear baggy clothing, had become disheveled, and very rarely left the house. She only kept in touch with some family members over the phone. They believed that maybe Erica was embarrassed by her unkempt house, so they didn't push her into inviting them over or meeting each other in person. According to Erica's lawyer, it was when Erica became pregnant for a third time that her fragile grasp on reality began to decay. However, there were times when Erica did venture out of the house and did appear to be somewhat of a normal mother. Neighbours said that they had seen Erica waiting at the bus stop with her 2 oldest children as they were going to school. She did the weekly shop at the local supermarket. Earlier in the year, Erica and Ray hosted their 10-year-old son's birthday at a Pines Entertainment, where they had pizza and cake and played laser tag and arcade games. Somebody in attendance said that Erica and Ray appeared to be very affectionate with one another and appeared to be completely normal. After the 4 children were taken away, the 2 oldest were sent to live with Ray's mother in another town. They were enrolled in school and lived in a large home with a basketball hoop and a swimming pool. It was a stark difference to the conditions inside the home in Blackstone. The 2 youngest children were placed in foster care. Today's episode is sponsored by TurboDebt. If you have over $10,000 in credit cards, personal loans, medical or payday loans, then TurboDebt can help you. Do you ever feel like no matter how hard you're working, you can't seem to get ahead? Sadly, a lot of people are simply working to pay their bills and to keep afloat. And a lot of people are relying on high-interest credit cards just to survive. Banks don't care they are wanting to keep you in debt because they only make money when you pay interest. That's where TurboDebt comes in. They will give you options to break the debt cycle and start putting money back in your own pocket. Head on over to turbodebt.com/morbid or click the link in my show notes for a free consultation today. That is turbodebt.com/morbid. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Towards the end of October, Defence Halpern stated that Erica had told him that she had given birth to her 3 babies in the years between the births of her 10-year-old son and her 3-year-old daughter. She said that one of the babies was born alive, and had lived for several days. She allegedly claimed to her lawyer that she placed the baby down for a nap in the bassinet, and when she returned an hour or two later, the baby was dead. Defence Halpern stated that the fact that the babies were found clothed did not necessarily mean that they were born alive or lived for any period of time. What was evidently going on behind closed doors was a stark difference to what Erica had portrayed on her social media. Shortly before the horrors began to unfold, Erica posted a photograph of something she had cooked, as well as a birthday update for her daughter, which read, "It's official, I have a teenager. Happy birthday, I love you so much." She had also shared a missing person post for a 2-year-old in West Philadelphia, and ironically had posted a status which read, "Some people should not be parents." In early November, Ray finally spoke publicly about the case. During a brief court hearing, he said that he was unaware of the inhumane and unbelievable conditions that his children were living in, because he was forbidden from going upstairs. He said that he lived in the basement of the home and was ordered by Erica to stay in the basement. He said that he and the 2 oldest children even joked that he was banished to the basement. He cried as he said, "I love them and I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I knew the house was dirty, but I had no idea that death was in my house." Outside of court, he briefly spoke with the media.
Did you ever see those kids?
I never saw the infant at all. I knew she was having babysitting the older one, and I saw her once. But that was it.
And what was your interaction with her?
Little.
Where did the 2-year-old spend most of her time?
Supposedly she was in Kayla's cleaner room, because she had Kayla clean her room so that the baby could stay there.
Ray's claims were extremely hard to believe. According to Erica's lawyer, Ray slept in the same bed as Erica, which was just steps away from the bedroom where the 2 youngest children slept. Despite this, Ray claimed that he never saw the 5-month-old, and only saw the 3-year-old once, and was allegedly told that she was babysitting her. The following month, Erica's charges were elevated, and she was indicted on 2 charges of murder in relation to the 2 babies found wearing diapers and clothing. Prosecutors stated that 1 baby still had the placenta and umbilical cord attached. Defence Halpern shared his dismay by stating that they still had no evidence that the babies had been murdered. Ray was also charged with 2 counts of assault and battery on a child, causing substantial bodily injury, 2 counts of reckless endangerment of a child, and 2 counts of animal cruelty. According to DNA testing, he was the father of all 7 children. The grand jury had reached the conclusion that the noise level caused by the 5-month-old would have been blistering, and that the 3-year-old banged repeatedly on the walls and doors of the bedroom. They believed that there was no possibility that Ray didn't know that there were 2 more babies living inside his home. Ray pleaded not guilty to all of his charges. He was ordered to be held on $100,000 bail. Erica pleaded not guilty to 2 counts of murder, 2 counts of assault and battery on a child, causing substantial bodily injury, 2 counts of reckless endangerment of a child, 2 counts of cruelty to animals, and 1 count of concealing a fetal death out of wedlock. In July of the following year, Defence Halpern filed a motion in Superior Court to dismiss the charges against Erica. He also announced that he would be seeking to suppress some evidence against her and was going to file a motion seeking funding to hire a forensic anthropologist who could assist in the defence. The case was slowly making its way through the justice system when in January of 2016, Defence Halpern appeared in court to argue for several charges to be dropped. In court, he argued that the murder charges were pure speculation by the prosecutors and said that there was no evidence that Erica had neglected her children or caused their deaths. Judge Shannon Friesen would allow Defence Halpern to argue his case before her, but ultimately, She announced that the murder charges would still stand and refused to dismiss them. The judge said that she reached her decision based on the baby's clothing, as well as testimony from the medical examiner, who said that the babies were full term. Furthermore, it would be revealed that Erica's son said that he had seen two babies in the home several years earlier. Then in August of the same year, via his defence attorney, Nicole Longden, Ray filed a motion to dismiss two counts of assault and battery on a child, causing substantial bodily injury. Prosecutors announced that they would be seeking to uphold the charges, stating that they believed that Ray knew about the children and did nothing to alleviate the dangerous conditions. In a hearing, Ray's defence also argued that he never actually had care or custody of the two neglected children, and that he believed that Erica was simply babysitting them. During the hearing, it was revealed that in a bid to keep up with her lies, Erica had created a fake Facebook account for a woman she claimed was the mother of the two youngest children. Furthermore, she had told the two older children to lie to Ray about the two younger children. In December, Defence Halpern asked the judge to throw out evidence which was found during the search of the home. He accused the police search of the home of exceeding the scope of the search warrant, which he referred to as vague, overbroad, and fatally defective. Prosecutors argued that given the bizarre and unusual facts of the case, the search was justified. The search warrant had listed possible crimes of kidnapping, trafficking, and child endangerment. The second search of the home, when the bodies were uncovered, had been ordered to search for documents relating to the identification or potential trafficking of the two youngest children, who had been found neglected inside the home. Defence Halpern argued before the judge that the search for documents would not have permitted a state trooper to open the closet door where one body was found, hidden underneath a towel. He said that the search was beyond the scope of anything that was allowed by the warrant. The judge would ultimately deny the motion to have the evidence found during the search to be suppressed. In early January of 2019, it was announced that Erica would be facing trial in June. She was facing two counts of second-degree murder. Before the trial, Defence Halpern announced that his client was mentally ill and that he would be raising her mental health as part of her defence. The trial began on the 4th of June. During opening statements, Defence Halpern said that his client was suffering from mental illness and that there was no evidence that his client had committed a crime. Prosecutor Christopher Hodgins, on the other hand, disagreed, stating that Erica's neglect caused the baby's deaths.
This is a case about children who lived under the same roof, but children who lived in vastly different worlds. These worlds were created by the defendant, Erica Martin. It was a world of light. This is a world of darkness. It was a world of kindness versus a world of cruelty. It was a world of the wanted versus a world of the unwanted. It was a world of life versus a world of death. These worlds collided quite by accident on the afternoon of August 28, 2014. It was on that day that a veil of secrecy was lifted from the home of Erica Murray. Erica Murray is mother of seven children, but five of those seven children were kept an absolute secret from the world until that day in August.
He stated that Erica had created two different worlds for her children, a world of the wanted and a world of the unwanted. He said he expected that the evidence presented during trial would show that Erica caused the deaths of two of her infants and that she exposed her other children to suffering by failing to properly care for them or by creating unlivable conditions in the home. The first witness to be called to testify was Betsy Brown, the neighbour who found the two babies in the bedroom. She said that her son was friends with Erica's 10-year-old son, and she had been looking after him that day while Erica was out of town. She said that shortly after Erica's son went home, he showed up at her house once again and said that he couldn't get the babies to stop crying. Confusion, first of all, came over Betsy. As far as she was aware, there were no babies in the house, just the 10-year-old boy and his 13-year-old sister. She stated, "As soon as I opened the door, I could hear the crying, the screaming. You could clearly hear children in distress." She said that she followed the boy upstairs as she was hit by a pungent smell, which smelled like rotting food and dirty diapers. She said that there was trash everywhere, and the second floor was very hot. It was also pitch black because the windows were covered with sheets. She was directed by the boy to two bedrooms. Upon entering the first bedroom, she saw trash and dirty diapers piled up on the floor and found a 3-year-old on the bed. She said that the mattress was sunken in from the urine and feces, and that there were baby handprints in feces on the wall. She said that feces was pretty much covering the baby, who was rocking back and forth almost violently on the bed.
Feces completely, pretty much covering her hair, body, everything. Dirty diapers, lots of dirty diapers. Baby bottles with maggots in them. Sorry.
She described how she went into the second bedroom and saw a younger baby on a bed with dirty diapers piled up on the floor. Betsy cried as she recollected taking off her shirt to try and clean the younger child up after police arrived at the scene. As she left, she saw Erica speaking with police at the end of the driveway. She testified that Erica appeared to be upset with her 10-year-old son, and she overheard her saying, "I can't believe you did this to me." Her testimony was followed by testimony from Blackstone police officer Michael Pavone, who corroborated the conditions found inside the home.
Yes, when I first entered the residence, you can immediately observe a lot of trash, recyclables, rotting food, plates, kitchen, similar to what's in your household trash bag, bottles strewn upon a place, feces, diapers, and there's a bug infestation.
Bug infestation?
Yes, sir. You can see like bugs flying around, basically.
And is that, self-contained breathing apparatus and suit that you referred to, was that in connection with the conditions of the residence?
That is correct.
Did you go to any particular locations in that residence?
I did, sir. I went to the second floor, back bedroom.
And on entering the bedroom, what did you do there?
After we were able to get in, we had a shovel, the pile of debris on the floor, which was a lot of recyclables, milk containers that still contain milk and fluids inside, rotting. We used a shovel to clear a pathway to begin our search. The bed was covered. There was a space on the bed where we had to remove debris to get a place to put our items off the floor and to conduct a thorough search. It was covered with the same items I described earlier, plus mold on the wall, stains on the wall. We started removing the trash to get to various locations in there to conduct our search.
He said that there were dirty dishes piled up in the sink, maggots in a blender, and bugs crawling around everywhere. In the basement, he said he found two pets that appeared to have been uncared for. Officer Pavone also told the judge that when a Department of Children and Family officials told Erica that they would be taking her children, she showed no emotion and showed more concern for her cat. Carrie Ann Phillips, a social worker with the Department of Children and Families, testified next. She said that she spoke with Erica on the porch and that she was calm and collected. She told Carrie Ann that she had given birth to all four children, but was embarrassed to tell the other children that the two younger children were hers. Around a week after this, DCF investigator Catherine Francie met with Erica and Ray. Once again, Erica was extremely calm. But Ray broke down, as Erica said she gave birth to the two youngest children at home, adding that they had never been to a doctor. During the conversation, Erica kept referring to the three-year-old as it. Blackstone Board of Health member and code officer William Walsh spoke about the squalid conditions of the home, as well as the disturbing condition of the two youngest children. He said that the three-year-old was covered in feces and the odour in the room was sickening. He mentioned the dirty diapers, which were piled up over a foot high in certain places. He said that in the bedroom with the six-month-old, there was the carcass of a dog. He also acknowledged Erica's cavalier attitude. Under cross-examination by defence Halpern, he suggested that Erica's calm behaviour was evidence of mental illness, stating, "Would you agree that the reality of her situation was that all of her children were being taken away by DCF, and she showed no emotional response to you? Did it appear that she did not seem to comprehend how bad the situation inside the home was when she told you it was just a little dirty?" He replied with, "Yes, she seemed unemotional the whole time." Up until now, very little was known about the two youngest surviving children. The courtroom would be pleased to learn that both of them were thriving. Dr. Peter Sell, a paediatrician at UMass Memorial Medical Center, told the jury that he had examined the three-year-old in the immediate aftermath.
She was seated on the floor with her legs in front of her, in a with her feet kind of arched, and she put her forehead to the floor, and so bent in half at the waist. We were very concerned for profound neglect, meaning that she had not had a lot of stimulation.
He said that she was pale, her nails were yellow, and she had extensive diaper rash and poor muscle tone. It was evident that she hadn't walked much. He also examined the five-month-old and said that her head was flat from being on her back, and she wasn't as active as an infant should be.
She was very content to lay flat on her back with her arms splayed out and her legs extended.
Dr. Sell saw the three-year-old again after she had been in foster care for a year. He said that when he saw her, she was a completely different child, stating, "She came running up to me with a big smile on her face. She was more engaged. She looked a lot better." Erica's defense team would be arguing that the children, whose murders she was charged with, could not have been murdered if they were never alive to begin with. Medical examiner Robert Weldon, who conducted the autopsies, said that the babies were far too decomposed for a cause of death to be determined. However, he said that there was no evidence of trauma to their bodies. He also couldn't determine whether they were stillborn or not, stating, "There were no internal organs to examine, and basically the overall state of the advanced decomposition didn't allow me to make that determination." However, he consulted with anthropologist James Pokeness, who said with reasonable certainty that at least one of the babies had been born alive. One had a neonatal line on its teeth, which is discoloration in enamel that develops after birth. Defence Halpern attacked the scientific basis of this opinion and suggested that they were both stillborn and that Erica's behaviour was the behaviour of a mentally ill and grieving mother. The anthropologist refuted this, stating, "In any study I've ever read, no one's ever found a neonatal line in a stillbirth." Following this testimony, a recording of Erica's interrogation was played out. The interrogation had taken place after the three bodies were discovered. Massachusetts State Police Detective Sean Murray said to Erica, "We went into an upstairs closet and we found skeletal remains up there." Erica let out an unintelligible noise, which was something between a laugh and a sob. She said, "I have no idea," before claiming that the baby was not hers. According to the prosecution, this was just the first in a long list of lies, which would crumble during the interrogation. Before revealing the discovery to Erica, she had told the detective that she had given birth to the two neglected children at home because Ray had told her that he did not want any more children.
"Were you afraid of something Raymond might do?"
with this third pregnancy? Has he ever said anything to you in the past about having another child?
He didn't want to have any more kids.
This was, of course, met with disbelief, to which Erica said he never said anything, so I assumed he didn't know. She admitted that in a bid to keep up with the lies, she had created a fake Facebook account for a woman she claimed was the mother of the two youngsters. She was asked if she loved her children and if she was proud of them. She began to weep as she said, "I got into it and I just don't know how to get out of it." When she was informed that a body had been found, she said that if they did a DNA test on the remains, it wouldn't come back as hers. Her resistance broke as she stated, "Something must have happened. It wasn't born alive." She said that she panicked when the baby was born dead and stuffed it into the closet. However, she then denied that the remains of the two other children were hers. In a later interview, Erica said that she gave birth to all three of the deceased babies, and that all three were stillborn.
Everybody in the house sleeping?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you gave birth, wasn't breathing. Did you take any type of life-saving measures? Did you CPR? Did you clear his airway?
I didn't know what to do.
Didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what'd you do? Exactly. Tell me exactly what you did. You remember? Did you cut the umbilical cord?
Yeah.
No sound at all, baby. Made no sound whatsoever.
However, she later changed her story and said that one of them had survived for around a week before passing away. She said she went to check on the baby and found that it wasn't breathing. When asked why she didn't call for help, she said that she panicked. Erica's defense team then called on Dr. Amos Grombaum, who had a lengthy career in gynecology and obstetrics. He testified that the condition of Erica's deliveries, which she said had happened in a bathroom alone, put the health of her children at risk. Unassisted home births are much more dangerous than giving birth at a hospital or giving birth at home with a midwife. He estimated that these births have a stillbirth rate up to 10 times greater than those in hospital. He said that Erica's case would likely have been on the upper end of that range. He said that the babies would have been at increased risk of infection and early death because of the grim conditions inside the home. After a week of testimony and evidence, the judge decided to dismiss one of the two murder charges against Erica, stating that there was no evidence that the baby was born alive and therefore could not have been the victim of homicide. Following the decision, the trial continued. Frank DiCaldo, a forensic psychologist, also testified during trial. He had administered psychological testing to Erica following her arrest. He said that he found Erica to be a friendless woman with possible anxiety and dependency disorders, and she was driven by fear that Ray would leave her. He said she was concerned that he would reject her or leave her. "I felt she had a pathologically dependent relationship with him." He said that Erica had an IQ of 84, which placed her on the low average range, although she had notable deficits in working memory and visual reasoning. She reported frequent feelings of depression, worthlessness, nervousness, and fear about her family, but she did nothing to address these issues. He said that Erica didn't display antisocial or psychotic traits, and appeared to possess little self-esteem. Attorney Halpern questioned Dr. DiCaldo whether Erica's submissiveness and lack of self-worth could have made her suggestible when interrogated by police, and he replied that it could be a vulnerability, but said he had not reviewed any of the police reports or interviews from the case. During cross-examination by the prosecution, Dr. DiCaldo admitted that the tests he had given were just a snapshot in time of her mental condition, and her anxiety, depression, and stress could have been amplified because of her predicament. His testimony was followed by forensic pathologists Lisa Rocio and Judith Edersheim, who both said that Erica had been emotionally abused by Ray, and that she was incapable of problem-solving, and didn't actually realise how bad the situation inside her home was. Dr. Rocio said, "Erica really did believe that she parented those children to the best of her ability, and loved them and cared for them, and believed she was a good mother to them. She had concluded that a perfect storm of personality disorders and abuse led to Erica being unable to cope with her problems. According to Dr. Edersham, Erica had displayed an irrational fear of abandonment, even as a youth. She said that Ray had been extremely controlling of Erica, and this escalated after Erica fell pregnant with their second child. She said that without her parents' constant support, Erica began to crumble. Both Erica and her mother said that while Ray never physically abused her, he displayed a number of controlling and abusive behaviors. He forced Erica to leave her job, became jealous when she socialized with other people, constantly asked her about her whereabouts, and threatened to abandon her. According to Dr. Rocio, Ray had used a pattern of behavior that instilled a sense of fear and dependency in Erica. She said that by the time Erica became pregnant with the younger children, she rarely left the house. Since she didn't work, Erica had no money and no access to the family's bank accounts. She said that Ray treated Erica like a servant and would call her dehumanizing names. Erica displayed no ability to productively cope with her circumstances or plan ahead, and would just ignore any problems. Dr. Rocio said that she had diagnosed Erica with avoidant and dependent personality disorders. This testimony would be rebuffed by Dr. Fabian Sala, a forensic psychiatrist, who said that nothing of the sort was true. He said that he reached the conclusion that Erica had no mental disorders, and that she had systematically planned the deceptions which led to the conditions in the home. He said, "The conclusions I reached is that Miss Murray did not suffer from a mental illness at any point in time in her life." He said that her actions and lies were not the result of impulse and fear, but instead were part of a masterful pattern of deception characterized by long-term planning and a lack of remorse. By the end of the trial, both the prosecution and the defense had offered two very polarizing portraits of who Erica truly was. During closing arguments, Assistant District Attorney Hodgins said that Erica was a serial liar who had deliberately left her youngest children to suffer in squalor while caring for her two oldest children. Defense Halpern, however, said that Erica was mentally ill and overwhelmed by her circumstances, living in fear of abandonment. He once again stated that there was no evidence of a murder, but instead, evidence of fear and abuse and mental illness. Assistant District Attorney Hodgins responded by stating, "Did Erica Murray know what she was doing? Did she appreciate the risks? I suggest you look at what she said to her son on that day. You have the answer. She said, 'How could you do this to me?' She knew." With all of the evidence presented, it was now up to Judge Janet Kenton Walker to reach a verdict. She found Erica Murray not guilty of second-degree murder. She did, however, find her guilty of animal cruelty and assault and battery on a child. Judge Kenton Walker said that the prosecution had failed to prove that Erica had caused the death of the baby. She called the case senseless and tragic, but said that she had to be guided by the evidence, as opposed to her emotions. She stated, "Regardless of how disturbing the facts surrounding this case are to the community at large, and to me as a parent, I cannot take into account those feelings." Erica Murray would be sentenced to 6 to 8 years in prison for the other convictions.
There are a lot of things that we do as judges that are difficult, but there is nothing more difficult than sentencing. We try to do it professionally, diligently. We try to take into account everything about the defendant that we know and can learn about, as well as what the society expects from us. And as I said, it's extremely difficult. There is nothing about this case that is normal. There is nothing about this case that is a rational, sensible set of events. So when I sit and I think long and hard about what sentence is appropriate, given the crimes that she has been convicted of, I have to take into account that the normal does not necessarily apply.
Erica got credit for the almost 5 years that she had already served. Following the sentence, Ray Rivera pleaded guilty to charges of assault and battery on a child with substantial injury, 2 counts of reckless endangerment of a child, 2 counts of animal cruelty, and 1 count of possession to distribute a Class D substance. He was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison for the assault and battery charge. He received credit for 1,642 days in jail. He was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for the reckless endangerment charge. He received credit for 136 days in jail. This meant that Ray would be serving around 2 years. On that fateful summer afternoon, Erica Murray's secret life of squalor was laid bare for the whole world to see. As police officers maneuvered their way through piles of trash, used diapers and vermin, they hauled out 4 children who had called the nightmare home. The grim case was one of the most disturbing cases the area had ever seen, and many people still can't help but feel as though true justice was not served. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Anna, Brenda, and Leslie. The support on Patreon seriously helps out. It helps to defray the cost of freedom of information requests, hosting, archive subscriptions, and much more. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive Morbidology merch, exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, as well as ad-free, early release episodes, and much more. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and you can cancel any time. The link to Patreon is in the show notes. Can I also ask that you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Crimes and Consequences TNT. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Everyone, I'm Talia, attorney and co-host of the true crime podcast, Crimes and Consequences. Listen to Crimes and Consequences to hear your favorite true crime cases, plus many murder stories you've never heard before. At Crimes and Consequences, we dive deep into the details of the crime. So if you have a fascination with the morbid side of human nature, you're really going to want to check us out. Go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere else you listen to your favorite true crime stories and subscribe to Crimes and Consequences, a hardcore true crime podcast.